Our next presenter is Ben Berkman from, he's also from the National Institutes of Health. He is a lawyer. He serves on more than one IRB, is that correct? Previously was at Georgetown University in their Ethics Center. And he's situated at NIH in bioethics and connected with the Genome Project.
Thanks. well, first let me get my disclosures out of the way. I always have to do this. The views expressed are mine alone. They do not represent the views of NHGRI, NIH, or the Department of Health and Human Services. And although I now really would love to have shares in stocks to go protest at the meetings, I don't have any relationships to disclose. I should also say that while it is true that I am trained as a lawyer, I disavow being part of the profession. I'm not actually a lawyer. I went to school with the intention of never practicing, and thus far in my career, I've been successful. And I do, again, full disclosure, I sit on the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, IRB, and I'm intimately involved in the National Human Genome Research Institute, IRB, as a consultant. So I think I was brought here to provide the IRB perspective, perhaps as a counterbalance to our two previous presenters. I should say I have somewhat complicated views about our current human subjects research protection system in general, and my goal for this talk, if you wanted me to defend IRBs so then you could yell at me, it's not going to happen. I'm not going to defend or attack IRBs or the federal regulations. Rather, my hope is to provide some ethical, legal, a little bit of conceptual background so we can understand in a little bit more detail. Both of our previous presenters have touched on this, but we can understand better this observed tension between the IRB system and community-based participatory research. I'm going to discuss whether the IRB model is appropriately tailored for the ethical review of CBPR, and in particular, I want to focus on whether the goals and institutional structures associated with IRB review are consistent with identification and protection from group harms, and that's going to really be my theme. I feel like I can't see some of you. I'm going to just try to... Oh, that made it worse. Hi.
Is it okay?
Yeah, it's fine. So just a quick roadmap slide. Given the ethical review of community-based participatory research has been identified as a significant barrier to conduct of these studies, I want to focus on the IRB, the requirement that IRBs review each of these protocols. And so first I'm going to provide an overview of what is our traditional human subjects research protection paradigm, this biomedical model that's been mentioned a number of times. I'm not defending it. I just want to explain the ethical and regulatory framework in which IRBs operate, for better or for worse. Then I want to briefly discuss the concept of group risks and harms, since I think that this is the major blind spot, or a major blind spot, in IRB evaluation, and is one of the most important problems in this area. Then, having laid out what IRBs are designed to do and a major area in which I think they might be lacking, I want to explore the debate. There's been some very interesting literature about, on both sides, the extent to which IRBs should or should not play a role in CBPR. And at the end, I just want to briefly discuss some of the challenges associated with community consent from the IRB's perspective, since community consent, community consultation, has often been presented as a potential complement to the IRB system. And just to be clear, I'm not going to have an answer for you. I just want to lay out some ideas and options for discussion. I'd love to hear your thoughts and comments on what role you think, or no role, you think that IRB should have in reviewing CBPR. So first, a basic overview of human subjects research protection. Why do we have them, and what are they designed to accomplish? So just The brief ethical justification, or one of the major ethical justifications, obviously there are compelling historical reasons for the existence of our current system. In general, we have concerns about ethical protection of human research subjects in large part because of a fear of exploitation, and the argument goes something like this. Research develops generalizable knowledge that improves health or increases understanding. People who participate in research are a means to securing that knowledge. As a means, these people can be exploited, that is, become a means for the benefit of others, and the ethical requirements for research are meant to minimize the possibility of exploitation. You're going to see hints of, again, biomedical research is going to run through my presentation, because that's really the dominant paradigm that we're dealing with. Of course, no discussion of IRBs is complete without mention of the Belmont Report, which articulates these three principles associated with protection of human subjects, respect for persons, which really ties to autonomy, beneficence, and justice. But what's interesting about the Belmont Report for our purposes today is that it really has no mention of community. And as I'll discuss, the Belmont Report, which led to subsequent regulations, which is really the basis for our current system, our IRB system, has been widely criticized for emphasizing individual rights and failing to account for issues flowing from interpersonal, family, and group relationships. With that said, Darlene and I come from the same department, so this slide will be familiar. I'm going to focus, she focused on a number of these quite well, I thought, but I'm just really going to focus on number five, or like she said, the order doesn't matter. But I want to talk about risk-benefit ratio in significant detail. But before I do, I said I'm not a lawyer, but I do have to tie it back to the regulatory framework and really some of the language, which I think is instructive in this case. So I'm sure you all know this. Title 45, CFR 46, the common rule with its various subparts that apply to specific populations. These are the rules that govern IRB functioning. The common rule in general, it describes who should be on IRBs, what we need for informed consent to be valid, and it charges IRBs to make sure that risks are minimized, research risks are reasonable in relation to expected benefits, subject selection is equitable, informed consent is obtained. This is just kind of the blueprint that governs the operation of IRBs. And one passage in particular, sorry about this slide, it's quite dense, but I really feel like this passage is important. I'll read it very quickly, but in order to approve research covered by the common rule, an IRB must determine that risks to subjects are reasonable in relation to anticipated benefits, if any, to subjects, and the importance of knowledge that may reasonably be expected to result. In evaluating risks and benefits, the IRB should consider only those risks and benefits that may result from the research, as distinguished from risks and benefits of therapies subjects would receive even if not participating. And then this is the key bit. The IRB should not consider possible long-range effects of applying knowledge gained in the research, for example, the possible effects of the research on public policy, as among those research risks that fall within the purview of its responsibility. I'm going to discuss this more in a bit, but this is the language that we talk about every IRB meeting. But before discussing the implications of that language, I think it might be helpful just from my insider perhaps perspective to delineate a framework for how IRBs actually measure risks and benefits. Again, for better or for worse, this is what we do. Step one is a four-step process. Step one, we look at the protocol to identify risks, we assess those risks, and then see if they are appropriately minimized or if there's any other way to minimize them. Risks can be physical, including death, disability, infection, psychological, depression, anxiety, social, some sort of stigma, economic, loss of job. But in general, these are risks to participants in the study. Step two is to look at the benefits. Again, physical, psychological, social, economic benefits. But this time we look at individual and social benefits. And then steps three and four are really the calculus, where you're weighing these against each other. If potential benefits to an individual outweigh risks to that individual, then go ahead. If the risks to the individual outweigh the benefits to the individual, then you add in this extra step where you look at risk to the individual against this nebulous social benefit of knowledge gained. So the important thing to note here is that while IRBs can consider social or community benefits, they're really only allowed to look at risk to individual. There's no consideration of group harms, of community harms. And again, if I return to this unpleasantly dense slide, this last sentence, which I read before, this is where it comes from, that IRBs should not consider the long-range effects of applying knowledge gained in the research. The results of the research on public policy is not a risk. So we're not allowed to, some would argue, think about group harms. If the main problem with IRB review of CBPR, or a main problem, is that IRBs aren't really designed to evaluate group harms, I want to pause just for a second and talk about what we mean by group, what we mean by group harms. And I think it's interesting to explore these terms because the definitions have implications for the kinds of ethical strategies that can be used. I really don't want to, cognizant of the time, I don't want to dwell on this, but there's a lot of discussion literature about these terms. An account that's useful to me comes from Hausman, a philosopher who often writes about group harms in the context of genetic research. I'm going to apologize and grossly oversimplify his taxonomy of group harms, but he describes two kinds of groups and two kinds of risks. There are risks flowing directly from the research process, and those are process-related risks, and risks flowing from the results of the research, and those are outcome-related risks. And there are two kinds of groups that might or might not be affected. There are structured groups that are capable of concerted action and have discernible group interests, where the group interests can be harmed. So think of an indigenous tribe or an academic department that has an identifiable that can act as a unit and has an identifiable set of interests. He also describes identifying groups which aren't capable of concerted action and don't usually have formal structure, but can still influence people's actions and attitudes. So here, think about a dispersed racial or ethnic group, or a collection of people with a certain disease. In this case, people in identifying groups can suffer individual harms because of their membership in a group, but the group as a whole can't suffer harms. He calls these group-mediated individual harms. And he creates this two-by-two table, and he adds labels to them. I don't want to dwell, as I said, his account is much more nuanced than we can explore here, but I want to emphasize really the two kinds of harms on the right, undermining and stereotyping. Undermining is outcome-related risk to groups themselves, and a good example here is genealogy research that undermines a shared origin myth. And then there's stereotyping, which is outcome-related risks to individuals based on a trait associated with a group. So again, he called this group-mediated harm to individuals, and an example here is employment discrimination against Ashkenazi Jews because of the breast cancer genetic test. So just to summarize, IRBs aren't good at reviewing group harms, and we have this set of group harms that seem really important. So the question then is, are IRBs the right entity to review group harms? And I want to review two sets of arguments. So option one is that IRBs have a moral obligation to consider potential harm to groups. And I should back up and say some scholars have argued for really a narrow definition of beneficence that assumes a researcher's fiduciary duty only extends to his subjects. It's really only about the researcher and and the subjects right in front of him or her. But other scholars have, like Resnick and Sharp, have disputed this claim, and according to their more expansive line of thinking, researchers have a broad societal responsibility because of a social contract that exists between the researchers and society. And in exchange for allowing the research enterprise to operate autonomously, they engage in actions that promote the common good. From this broader perspective, it isn't difficult to impose a responsibility on researchers that extends beyond the individual research subjects. According to this account, researchers and the IRBs that monitor them have a responsibility to consider the broad impact of their research on third parties, including groups and communities. So, and then you would engage in the ubiquitous balancing test, where you would look at the probability of harm times the magnitude of the harm and weigh it against the value of the research. But in this case, instead of just looking at the probability of individual harm and the magnitude of individual harm, you could also account for group harm, third-party harm, community harm. So that's a case for IRBs to engage in discourse about group harms, and there's a lot more literature about why they're not well situated to consider potential harms to groups and thus why it may be not right for them to be reviewing community-based participatory research. So I'm going to go through all of these arguments briefly because I very much want to leave time for questions. So first, as I've already discussed, the current regulatory framework creates an IRB system that focuses on individual subjects. The regulations, as currently construed, really preclude consideration of long-term distant group risks and harms. And this argument really represents the thing that Resnick and Sharp were reacting against, a narrow view of beneficence. There's really a question of community representation on the IRBs. The regulations require that there's a community representative on every IRB, but that person generally represents a generic non-scientist perspective. They're not really there to provide particular comments on the interests of a specific group. And I would argue, this is probably where I need to emphasize that this is just my view, but even if you could have a suitable representative on a given IRB, the technical nature of IRB discourse can sometimes make it difficult for a layperson to express their legitimate concerns in that context. So third, there's this broader question about policy and distributive justice, and I'm not sure that IRBs are well suited to consider some of these broad questions. Decisions with a wide societal impact should be taken by an appropriate legislative or regulatory body, not an individual IRB, which is ill-suited to make decisions with expansive consequences. Really, they're designed to evaluate the importance and burden of an individual research protocol. They're not really in the business of making science policy or distributing societal resources. Interestingly, in my department, we have an ethics consult service, which isn't an IRB, but we provide advice to researchers. We mediate ethical disputes, and we just had a consult which raised questions about the budgetary implications of a potential proposed protocol. The bottom line is, if it was successful, the research was going to lead to an increased burden on an identifiable federal drug entitlement program. And this question about whether or not we should be doing research that was going to impose this budgetary concern, we started talking about it, but then there were serious questions about whether we should even be talking about it, and if we should, how we as a research ethics body should approach a decision with wider, in this case, national implications. Fourth, is this issue of coordinating decisions, consistency in coordinating decisions. Equity demands that similar cases should receive comparable review, and right now, IRBs nationally have no easy way of speaking to each other to ensure consistency of review. And just to provide an example from NIH, at NIH we have 11 IRBs. They're kind of thematically organized. And they all have different processes. They all have different procedures. There's really only very few limited mechanisms to talk to each other. So if you have similar community-based participatory research that goes to different ones, you might get different kinds of reviews. And actually earlier, the comment was made that from year to year, the composition of an IRB can change and you can get different outcomes. So there's no consistency, there's no coordination. And from an equity perspective, you worry that different groups would be treated differently because of that. Fifth, there's a major concern about IRB resources and expertise. If IRBs expanded their horizon to begin considering group harms, this would necessarily lead to an expansion of their work. Some people have argued that it would even lead to a review of non-human subjects research that has an effect on groups. And this is a problem in a system where many feel that IRBs are already overburdened and that long review times are a barrier to conducting research. Right before I got to NIH, they conducted a survey of the intramural researchers, and guess what? The number one named barrier to research at NIH was IRBs. I say before I got there, I'm trying to make that better. And so if you're adding something to their plate, that's just going to make things worse. And furthermore, given this existing lack of resources, there's an accompanying concern that an expanded focus would take IRB attention away from what they're really designed to do, which is focus on individual research protections. And their focus would be diluted and our individual protections would be reduced. Sixth, there's a question about whether, how, and to what extent, who gets to determine whether, how, and to what extent research could lead to a group harm. So there are a couple of ways you could frame this, but the one that I think is interesting is, what's the result if the IRB disagrees with the community researcher partnership? And we saw that with the first presentation. For example, what would happen if the IRB thought the research was too risky, but the CBPR partnership didn't? Whose judgment trumps? In that case, the IRB's judgment trumped, and it didn't resonate. I mean, it felt like the wrong decision. So there's this question about who gets to determine, who rightfully gets to determine what is or isn't a group harm. Finally, there are questions about informed consent. There's been lots of literature about the need to move beyond individual informed consent to incorporate concepts of community consultation and, when feasible, community consent. Some have even proposed creating entities to completely replace the IRBs, while others see community consent as a tool to complement the IRB system. To the extent IRBs are going to remain the dominant research subject protection entity, I have very real concerns about an IRB's ability to evaluate the appropriateness of community consent. To my mind, IRBs are very well structured to evaluate the adequacy of individual informed consent, but group consent is much more complicated and raises questions about a number of issues that IRBs might not be competent to consider. Things like, what is a group? This is just one account in the literature about the 10 characteristics that can be used to describe groups. And most of these things, I would feel very uncomfortable asking my colleagues on the IRB to, for example, determine the comprehensiveness of a community's culture. So I'm not sure that IRBs are good at determining what is a group. There's questions of who is a legitimate group representative. When you have multiple leaders, if you have a political and a religious leader, is that really the IRB's job to go in and think about who has the authority? And then there's a subgroup problem or an individual minority problem where a group hides dissenting voices. If there's a subpopulation that's systematically marginalized, like women in a male-dominated society, or if there are individuals who feel pressure one way or the other, if a community consents to research and the individual doesn't want to do it but feels pressure to participate, or the reverse, where if the community decides not to do research or to cease a research relationship, but the individual wants to start or continue engaging in the research because they're getting individual benefit. Again, these are generic problems, but they're ones that I'm not sure an IRB is well-suited to mediate. So where does this leave us? As I was preparing for this and discussing my thoughts with colleagues in my department, we all agreed that IRBs, as currently structured, seem to be a poor choice for reviewing group risk and harm. But given that we have a robust IRB structure in place, we also weren't convinced that they should be completely marginalized. I'd love to hear your thoughts and experiences on that debate, but I'll leave you with one concrete recommendation. If we do want to use IRBs to actively review group harms resulting from community-based participatory research, I think a necessary first step will be to revisit the regulations. And I mean more than just the regulations governing risk-benefit analysis, but really looking at the requirements for informed consent, IRB membership, training mandate, education mandates. I mean, I showed you earlier the subparts under the common rule, and one might consider creating a distinct common rule subpart, subpart E or subpart Q, to provide special protections and procedures for research involving groups for community-based participatory research, to ensure that IRBs have capacity and competence to incorporate review of group harms into their deliberations. Thanks.
Thank you. We have now about 15 minutes for discussion.
To create these subcommittees? I mean,
yeah, it has been. Many times we feel there was one with protocol in which we understood the intention of the researcher, but the law, the framework of the law and the regulations of the IRB were in favor of allowing us to approve the protocol. So we decided to consult to an ad hoc committee, and they kind of based our decision making on having that extra view. In that sense, it's helpful.
I mean, the regulations do allow or even encourage IRBs to go outside of their membership when they feel that there's some information that they don't have that an external source, an expert, could provide. But it's not mandated. Each IRB has a different personality, has a different ethos. And so I'm not sure that, it sounds like your IRB has developed a very interesting and productive model. And I would love for that to spread to others. But since there's no mandate and some IRBs are more or less resistant to hearing what other people have to say, that if everyone adopted that, it would be great. But they don't, or at least not right now.
I'd like to add to that. My experience has been, especially with Hawkins, that it's not a formalized ad hoc group that I'm working with through Hopkins, but since they have They have the Regional Health Corporation is a review board, and each tribal council is a review board. It's sort of ad hoc, but it's not formalized through Hopkins. Hopkins is listening. And so what they're, you know, even though they have a very tight protocol of what they need in research, I have gone back to them multiple times over 2 years. I mean, the time period, unfortunately, the CBPR is extensive, but I've gone back to them multiple times and said, no, the community will not accept this. This has to be different. And because of the power of the group, the power of a group force as opposed to just the power of one community member, I think if I just had one UPIC individual sitting on Hopkins IRB, it wouldn't have the power. But having the power of these two basically ad hoc groups, that, and one of them being very formalized, requires all research. The UConn-Pensacola Health Region Board requires all research in that region to go through their review board. The academic institution and the funding institution, my funding is through NHGRI, they listen. So I think a community group, but it has to be established.
The regulations, and there's no IRB police that are going to come in and shut down an IRB if they start considering social harm alongside of social good. And I very much agree with you that it really is somewhat artificial to try to separate them out. I guess the point I want to emphasize is in cases where IRBs aren't thinking about social harms, aren't recognizing them, the regulations don't force them to consider them more actively. And I guess that's the real critique that I want you to take home. IRBs can consider lots of things that aren't in the regulations, and I'm sure they ignore them all the time. But there's no formal mechanism. They operate oftentimes in terms of checklists, and so there's no social harm checklist which would force them to look at those issues.
You know, I was just so struck by the prohibition on even considering policy that you highlighted in your talk, because I think that's a real I think that is from a critical perspective, I think that's been a problem in terms of the whole way we characterize research and what we're up to, is that, oh no, you know, policy, that's a whole other thing. You know, the research is just the research, and it has, you don't even think about values and policy and actually doing something. You're just getting the facts, you know, and I think this objectivist view of research is obviously problematic when it comes to something like CBPR.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I've seen that a lot in the communities that I work with. And one of the main objectives that they want is to change that. And that they, the research that, that are done in these UPID communities cannot, can no longer just be what we may consider bench science or just specific data collection. Policy change comes from it, health system change comes from it, increased community capacity, resources has to come from it. It has to be written into the research from the very beginning, or they're not allowing it in. And I think it's great. It becomes, research becomes a whole different a paradigm, and it takes on a dynamic of its own that is much, much bigger than what I think we've seen with just individual research.
I've served on two IRBs, one a community research initiative for AIDS in New York, AIDS research, and so it's a community-sponsored community initiative that does research. And I also chaired for 2 years the IRB at the New York City Department of Health. I thought I was pretty familiar with the regs. I don't think we ever interpreted a prohibition to long-term implications, except in the argument of if it's research related to an individual, that society doesn't trump the individual. It's sort of been the guiding force. Certainly at the Department of Health, and particularly internal, Department of Health-sponsored research and Department of Health research initiatives are often policy focused, or the end outcome is designed, research, to influence program planning, program funding, and public health policy. So I don't know that we ever experienced that tension. Probably the people who have the hardest time coming to the health department are biomedical researchers, if they're outside, and internally, probably the only biomedical research that we have would be initiated from the Bureau of TB Control, looking at different protocols and possibly drugs used for for addiction, substance abuse, or biologicals for vaccines, but I'm not familiar with any recent studies.
And what I think is interesting about that is that I have a public health degree alongside my law degree, so
I should have mentioned that.
I sympathize with that, but really situated in much more biomedically oriented IRBs, we have a different interpretation. There is disagreement in the literature. I mean, it's not an ironclad interpretation of that part of the regulation, but you can read it that way, and some more biomedically oriented IRBs do read it that way.
You know, I just wanted to make one point, and I don't know if there are any people from funding agencies here, but I think one of the things that I was struck by in listening to your talk was that you can expect that you are going to have to go back to the IRB multiple times, and the time that all of this involves is just so substantial. All this negotiation that is taking place on so many levels, I don't think funders yet really get how much a time differential there is likely to be if you do this the way you're supposed to do this kind of research.
That's definitely one of the struggles that I've had, challenges that I've had. Like I said, I actually started the concept of this 4 or 5 years ago, initially starting with traditional healers in Alaska, talking about genetic research that was being done in Alaska, and no one had asked communities what they thought of it. And so one of the things that I can actually see coming out of my research will have nothing to do specifically with my research. It's actually going to be the learning curve of the institutions, the struggle that I've worked with, that I've had working with Johns Hopkins and the different institutions that I'm involved in because of my funding through NINR and NIH and NHGRI, that getting helping them understand not only the different time frames that the institutions work on, but the communities that I work with, they're out fishing, they're out hunting, you don't talk with them. And if they, a good example is they were supposed to their review board meets every 2 months. You have to submit your protocol 2 months prior to that, so you're looking at a 4 month delay there. Well, mine was supposed to be reviewed the day that they review on a Monday. Their meeting last year was on December, just prior to Christmas. Christmas was like a Wednesday or Thursday last year, something like that. Well, they wanted to leave early that day because it was prior to Christmas, so they didn't get to review mine, which meant it delayed another 2 months. You don't argue with that. And so I have to go back to my funders and say, sorry, I know this has taken a lot longer, but this is the process that we have to respect. And in many, many groups, if those processes are not respected, they will close down research in their groups. They'll just say, put a moratorium on, you guys aren't coming in. And I've actually, that was one of the challenges that I had to deal with in this group is prior research that was done many years ago by a researcher from Johns Hopkins. So just having a name coming in, I mean, there's all of these challenges that you have to come up against that slows things down tremendously.
Are these all hospitals?
What's that?
Hospitals?
These are all hospital-based IRBs. Different ones for every single one. Some have separate giveaways. But the process, the timing was unbelievable. And I managed to do all but two within probably a four-month period. And the last two took an average of 7 months to get through IRB. So, the whole process itself is really prohibitive to research. And that's even
sounds like you've got a paper there.
Yeah. I had very similar experience to yours with a community project where it was on home health nurses, and the IRB that I approached was wanted to consider the tools for trainers of the biobanks research subject. They have a way to access their identity.
I think our time is up. I invite you, if you have other comments, to share. Please stick around. Thank our presenters for coming. And hope to see you at other sessions.
What a great combination.
That's great.
That's a really nice
combination. I'm so grateful to all of you that you were able to come. Yes, I think, as you said, a good combination. Really. I know your slides are recruiting for people to come working with.
Yeah. I always show a lot of good slides.
I was going to say, they just would not consider the business the unit of their office. Because we have a workplace violence prevention program going on now where that was the, after doing other things, that was the approach I took with IRB, and we, that the business is one, and the business we have research subjects, that the employees who are disseminating the project are doing this project and that the data you're collecting, so the person's officers and your research subjects, they consent to our follow-up interviews with him.
Thank you so
all
much.
The data is from our businesses when they go out into the community and bring out a program. It's considered program. It's considered program evaluation and the core subject.
Yeah, well, see, you know, some other people have said to me, you know, I wouldn't even have gone to that. Well, you know,
the whole, I mean, whenever you say you're going to collect a visitor,
right.
This
is what we said. This is what we said. The state is doing this. And they said, well, that's the state. They're not doing it for research. Yeah. So that was the, yeah.
Yeah, well, like when you move out of hospitals, but even within hospitals, I didn't even think biomedical as well, that extreme one.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, like I said, it could well be that if we had done this another year or gotten a different committee, it would have been different.
Even in this hospital one, I can get approval year one, and then we go back to review, the IRB will change, and I'll have to modify it. I mean, it's not for the life of the project, because you have to renew every year, but I'll get a whole new IRB committee who's going to say, well, wait, this is no good, and we need you to switch.
Oh, dear.
The amount of
year.
But thank you.
I worked with Pat Benner when you were doing.
I was looking out at you and thinking she looks familiar.
Yeah, well, I know it's been a while, but yes. So I actually want to talk to you about something else. I enjoyed the presentation; it was great. I'm writing a chapter for Diana Mason's policy nursing policy book. They want a community activism chapter, so I'm writing that. And they, you know, said, "Well, do you have graphs or photographs or anything?" So I was wondering. I know on the website the Nightingales. You had some pictures of nurses.
Yeah, but the thing is, I'm writing a chapter too about the Nightingales.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the best
example. Well, actually, I can't remember if we had pictures last time or not.
So is that one with the activism then? Maybe it's one of my friends' ours after.
Oh, maybe it is. Yeah, I think it might be. Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, because they had. You know, this is a new chapter, the community activist. So it's just an introduction to community activism. So if yours is going to already be there, were you going to put pictures in it? Or what we could. Who's your editor?
Judy Levin.
Okay, yeah.
Why don't you ask them where it fits?
Okay.
I mean, I'm happy to give you pictures if
we're
not using them for
your
ours.
Chapter. Yeah.
You know,
okay.
I can't remember. I don't think we actually have pictures. We had. I'm trying to remember, but they might have. You know, this is the second time around.
Oh, yours has been. Yeah, okay. Well, see that what they did this time is they've got this introductory chapter. Okay. Well,
yeah.
So then you're already.
Well, just you know, email me. You have my email.
I
can give you my card.
Right. That would be perfect. Because I was going to contact you before, and then actually,
Yeah, you can just email me
once
you figure it out with them.
Yeah, that'll be fine.
Because, I mean, I've got pictures, but
whether it's... Right, and I've seen some on there, and I thought, you know, because a lot of your example is actually with nurses. A lot of what I'm writing about is not necessarily about...
With nurses.
Nurses.
Uh-huh.
It's about community activism. Great. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, good. Good to see you in that space.
Yeah.
Enjoy the rest of the session.
Well, I'm looking forward to the new edition of the book, you know.
I mean,
it's amazing, you know.
I might try to make that on Wednesday, but I have a presentation tomorrow morning.
Okay. Okay. We can look, and I'll tell you where it might actually be. I've got so many different folders.
try to keep myself organized.
Which is not a
never ending task.
Not a happy achievement. Or it is that. It would be happy if I achieved it, but.
A constant pursuit.
Sunday, Tuesday. Why doesn't it say we're Wednesday? Because that obviously isn't the right organized sheet. Maybe it is here. Okay, just turn the page. Wednesday morning. Ah, it's right in this room.
Okay.
6:30 to 8. I can be more organized than I do. By accident. And I realized, while I was sitting here during the last speaker's talk, that I had left my shawl in the other room. And
oh,
I'm
no.
hoping. I was like, oh, God. Now, is it still going to be there?
What happens when you travel and trying to keep track of multiple
right.
things?
And well, I had put it on the chair behind me, so when I got up, I just. So maybe it's, I'm hoping it's still there.
Are you guys coming to the meeting tomorrow?
Say that again?
Oh, is it tomorrow?
Yeah, at 9, tomorrow.
Yes. Is there anything? Oh, it's gone.
Steve,
it's gone. I've got the
They said I could do it here, but I have to figure out how.